The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Meg, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah. Now, for people that are listening, this episode is dropping on a Tuesday, which my episodes never drop on Tuesday, but that's because your book just launched today. If someone's listening to this on its release day, your book has just come out. Just before we dive deep into it, just give us the 10,000 foot view, like elevator pitch of the book.
Awesome. This will be my first time doing that. So let's see if I get it right. So basically, it's a memoir and it's called Becoming Unsilenced, Surviving and Fighting the Troubled Teen Industry. And really, it's about my journey, you know, throughout my troubled teen industry programs, but then also how I had to learn to become unsilenced. I had to learn to use my voice and what kind of things I had to go through in order to learn that lesson that eventually led into finding unsilenced and being able to, you know, create a organization that was going to be working within this movement, and kind of a little bit about what unsilenced does. But in reality, it's really about my journey to unsilenced and how I got there.
Perfect. So if you're listening to this, just grab a copy of Becoming Unsilenced now before
yes.
you forget, you know, 30 minutes into the episode. A friend of mine always says, like, when you hear a book recommendation, buy it right then and decide later if you're going to read it, because you'll forget in the next couple of minutes. So go grab a copy of that right now. But while they're doing that, let's go back in time to your introduction to the troubled teen industry itself. I know you grew up in Newport Beach, California, mm-hmm. so fellow Californian. I love mm-hmm. to hear it. So what was it that you were experiencing as a youth that got you labeled as a troubled teen? And I'm sure we can talk about why the label's not particularly helpful, but what put you in that box as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, there's two different scopes, right? I have the scope of what I can look back on and be like, oh, it was that, which was really ADHD and undiagnosed autism. But then also the actual physical behaviors of what was happening back then, and really what you saw from other people's perspective, which was really reaching for, you know, marijuana to kind of self-medicate my anxiety. I started pushing back against authority and skipping out on classes and, you know, being grounded a ton. I think at one point I just kept continuously being grounded, that I was like racking up grounding days of like 3 months at that point, to where you're just like, well, I'm in a hole, so I might as well just sneak out anyway. So I started sneaking out, and I started becoming, God forbid, interested in boys and, you know, having sex. And that was, you know, that's a big no-no. So I think it was just all of a sudden I entered teenagehood and my parents were like, oh, crap, I don't know how to handle this. And I think that was exacerbated by the fact that my brother, who is 6 years older and not adopted, so he was a biological child, and then I'm adopted. I think that played into it, because he was extremely well behaved. Like, didn't have any of those issues on the exterior from what you could see. You know, he graduated high school with like a 4.3 grade point average and then went to Northwestern. And here I was skipping out on school, you know? So I think that contrast of like, whoa, we're not prepared for that, was kind of a perfect storm into them hiring the educational consultant that, you know, where that's going to lead. So,
right. Do you think because you were adopted, do you think there was also that fear of like, the other, like that, oh, we don't, you know, we don't know necessarily all the family history. We don't know how to deal with this. Like, do you feel like you were treated differently just because it wasn't a biological connection?
I think as far as treatment from my parents, I felt treated the same as far as love, as far as opportunities and all of that. It was very self-imposed, but I always saw things from a lens of I don't belong and I'll never be understood. And then there's that, you know, really fun one of no one wants me, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that it was also exacerbated by the incredible amount of bullying that I got in grade school. It was really, really bad to the point where kids are saying, no wonder your parents gave you up. You're so ugly and, you know, all that stuff. So it exacerbated those issues, but it was really self-imposed. It was never, I will say this, that in my exchanges with them, because I didn't see those types of exchanges with my brother, it made me self-impose that feeling of they don't know how to handle me, which made me feel bad or wrong or different in a way that kind of set me up for those, you know, poor feelings about myself.
Right. Yeah. So the feelings of otherness were actually kind of coming from you as the source.
Correct.
Do I fit into this mold? Yeah. I love understanding the framework because you hear the stories, one of two things. You have the parents that really didn't like their kids and were looking for a way to offload them into something. And the troubled teen industry becomes a very welcome, you know, atmosphere for that. But then it sounds like your parents were coming at it from a place of truly concerned about you, loved you, wanted to keep you safe, which led to you feeling like, oh, I'm in this hole that I can't get out of. It's a really strange place to be. And from someone who's grew up in religious fundamentalism, you know, I know many people who expressed exactly what you just said, which is I'm already in the hole. I'm already being judged in my eyes for expressing all these things that are sinful in that world or, you know, or troubled in this environment. So I might as well just live up to that personality. I might as well go ahead and sneak out. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to be grounded an extra couple of weeks. Like, what's the difference?
Right.
So how quickly did that kind of, I guess, progress into more and more sneaking out? Or like, just how quickly did it progress into a not great space?
You know, I think it was really a fight for trying to figure out who I was. And this is super normal, right? If you look at, you know, Erikson's psychosocial stages of development, this is something that's expected during this age group of pushing back against authority to find out who you are and your place within society. So I think that there was that going on for sure. And it may have been at a rate that was a little bit faster just because I didn't feel accepted anywhere. I didn't think anyone understood me. You know, I was really, well, I don't even know the word to use, but people called me like socially off. And which looking back, like I was undiagnosed autistic at the time and had no mask or ability to, but I just didn't feel accepted. And so that drive, along with like the normal drive of being a teenager, made me try to grasp at things that could potentially make me feel accepted. So, you know, being able to grab a joint that someone's offering, all of a sudden I'm accepted by this group of counterculture people that are like, wow, I belong now. And so I kind of latched onto that probably pretty quick. And because it was the first time I felt like I had friends.
Right.
And so I think I very quickly adapted to doing their behaviors, which was skipping school and things like that. So I got put into this little group. And then I adapted very quickly into doing the things that they were doing, regardless of, I don't even know if I really thought about it. I was just so desperate to belong.
Right. Yeah. Which is a normal feeling. And that's where things get lost too, is that I think sometimes parents forget that, like, that exploration stage happens and it can look different. And there's things that, you know, at 13 or 14, you probably shouldn't be exploring, or things that, you know, you would try to guide your kids away from. But that exploration stage is so normal, whether that's sexually, whether that's finding friend groups, whether that's, you know, experimenting with whatever activity, like, we all go through that stage at some level. And I think it can be forgotten when you're looking at it happening through someone else's eyes, when you have hindsight on your side. And we can go into this as deeply or as quickly as you want to, but I know there was a major kind of tipping point that involved an assault that happened in one of the times you're out with friends. And I'll let you kind of guide where we go in that conversation, but I know it was like the catalyst for some more severe action taking place later on down the road. So you skip school with some friends, you know, what were kind of the next things that happened? Because to me, it sounds like the response to this was equally, if not more so, traumatic than the event itself.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting because if you, you know, in my talks with survivors, I've talked a lot about, you know, what happened right before. And mm-hmm. I feel like it's so common that I hear someone had some kind of like sexual assault that went on. And So it's really interesting to kind of look at that. And so basically, yeah, I skipped school with one of my good friends and we decided we're going to have this, you know, guy on the side of the road, you know, buy a 7-Eleven, I think it was, buy us some beer. And he told us that if we bought him a bagel, he would buy us some beer. And we thought that was an incredible idea. And we just started drinking the beer, going in and out of the alleys in Costa Mesa and over by my school. And he kind of like started following us. And we thought it was funny at first. And he had like, he had a bike and we were in the alley and he kind of like showed us this knife, but it was in a way of like, look at this cool thing I have. Isn't this a cool knife? It wasn't, but it was still threatening. Like I knew that it was, he was showing us it to let us know that he had a knife, but it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm going to kill you. But we saw the knife and then I don't know what happened next. I completely blacked out, which was weird because we only split a 6-pack, which, you know, there's no way I could have been at blackout, even at a 15-year-old at my weight. So I believe, I have no proof, but I believe I was drugged and so was my friend. And when I woke up and came to, I had, you know, my pants around my legs and we were in the park and I saw my friend just kind of like draped over him, like straddling him. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on? And I heard someone walking just as I was waking up. And I was like, you know, wake up, wake up, wake up. You got to get up. And he freaked out and he ran and ended up being a police officer.
Oh, wow.
And I know the police officer saw him. He had to have seen two 15-year-old girls and a 32-year-old man in a park. And, you know, this is back in 2001, though, where it was like, if a young girl is with an older guy in any capacity, they're the temptation, right? It's nothing to do with the guy, but I don't know, for whatever reason, he decided to question us versus going after this grown man who was just alone in a park with young children. And I thought it was so, he was like asking us about what school we go to. And I was still processing what was happening. So I ended up giving a wrong zip code with my address. And I thought I was so smart to give just the exact address I had, but a wrong zip code, you know. And on the way back to school, we decided that if we got caught, we would tell the truth, but we didn't want to get in trouble for the drinking and leaving campus, right? We were so scared of getting expelled. So we decided if we got caught with being off campus, that we would tell them that knife we had seen. He showed up at a payphone when we were using it and made us leave and made us drink, right? Because we just didn't want to take accountability for that. And we ended up getting in trouble and saying the lie about how we got off campus. And, you know, the FBI got involved and police and it was really bad. We had to go into like a victim advocacy center and show a psychologist like with bears how he like did everything he did and everything like that, like with the two-way glass. And and then all of a sudden I went to school one day and I got called in by the principal and I could see my friend's face on the way out as I was going in. And she just said like, I'm sorry. And I was like, oh, crap, she told the truth. And at that point, that was the very troubled teen moment, because this detective is telling me that they no longer believe me about the actual assault, because I had lied about how I got off campus and about me deciding to drink. And then they proceeded to tell my parents. I just found out this like a year ago. They told my parents I was not assaulted and that I was not telling the truth. And so I don't know the timeline as far as, you know, if I think about it, my parents had to have had a educational consultant at this time. But it did seem like maybe three weeks later, I was abducted in the night. And so they expelled us because we had consumed alcohol during school hours, and it was a zero tolerance policy. And so I had to finish off school, which was like 2, maybe 3 weeks in a trailer in the back of the school, like in, you know, like a makeshift classroom for 3 weeks to allow me to actually finish a semester. But in January is when I woke up in the middle of the night, and that's when my whole troubled teen industry story starts. So,
yeah, I heard you recount a kind of truncated version of that story on A Little Bit Culty, and it's one of those things that's horrifying to me, because, I mean, for so many reasons, but just like the lack of education that still exists among law enforcement, among teaching staff, among parents. And, you know, it's the one of the scary things for me, and I'm sure we can talk about this a little bit later too, is now on the advocacy side, where you're dealing with victims of assault, or dealing with people that have experienced something horrific, you're trying to get them to, you know, see what action they can take. And sometimes it's really hard to earnestly recommend, hey, take this to this law enforcement entity, especially if you know what area they're in, and all those different factors where you go, this person in Missouri is not going to have a great experience, or this person in this realm. And even beyond that, it's like, when I hear your story, the fact that you were treated as the criminal through the remainder of high school, or that period of high school, versus being given, you know, actual care for this thing that happened, is really just, it's frustrating, and it makes me upset. And it's even more frustrating that, you know, again, this is early 2000s, and these things are still happening 2 decades later in story after story, is really, really horrific to me. You alluded to this, but January comes, you're awakened at 2 or 3 in the morning. There's people in your house that you don't recognize. This is an experience that every time it's described to me, it sounds like it can't be real, because it sounds like a movie script.
I know.
Like, and I'm sure at the time it probably did feel real. Like, walk me through that process. And for those that aren't familiar with what is being described, like, this is not a one-off experience. This is something that's happened time and time again. You're waking up 2, 3 in the morning as a teenager. What happened next?
Yeah, I mean, so there were two people, a man and a woman. I later found out the man was colloquially like called Big John by other people that were in the next facility that I was at. And apparently he kidnapped a bunch of people too.
That was just his job.
Yeah, that was just his job. Just Big John doing his job. So they woke me up at like 2, 3. I don't even remember. But I remember them saying, you're coming with us. And I said, no, I'm not, just instinctively. Right. And I remember at that point just not knowing what was going on. And my first thought was that I was being arrested, because the night before, I remember I had smoked pot in my room, and I thought I had been like turned in, or I don't even know. And so my first thought after that was, where are my parents? And I kind of looked around, and I didn't see them at that point. And I said, no, I'm not. And they said, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. And then they kind of, I forget what they said, but they alluded to the hard way being handcuffs. And so I just was like, oh, okay. And as soon as I got out of bed, I saw my parents in the doorway, and my mom was crying, and they were both saying, like, we're not abandoning you. We're not abandoning you. And I think I cussed at them. And then I was like, okay, can I go to the bathroom? And they're like, no, we have to watch you. So I had to go to the bathroom in front of them. And then I was like, can I change? And they're like, we have to watch you. So I had to change in front of them. And I remember the last thing that I asked is, can I at least pack a bag? And their response is what made me flip out. And they said, your parents already did. Wow. And that is what flipped that switch. And I remember just cussing them out, saying, I'm never talking to you ever again. I hate you, all this stuff. And then I remember just being thrown in the back of a big black SUV, like Suburban. And we were off to LAX, and I wasn't allowed to know where I was going. And I remember specifically they faced me away from the gate so I couldn't see where I was going. And I didn't know where I was going until I was on the plane. And the pilot came on and said, we're on a flight to Boise, Idaho. And I was like, what? And as soon as we took off, I remember we were in the bulkhead, I believe. And I would think I was by the window, and then they were next to me, kind of smushing me in. And they handed me two letters, one from my mom, one from my dad. And I think that's when I really disassociated. And I don't even remember the flight. I don't remember what I felt. And the last thing I remember is after that is walking through the doors of Intermountain Hospital and the feelings that I had with that. Because it was just like the space of time, hours, that I don't even remember at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, this story is one that's been repeated so many times with people that have experienced different variations of this. And I mean, going from 15, leaving your home, I know for many people, this is sometimes their first time on a plane, you know, leaving or leaving out of the state. Like, talk to me about arriving at the actual facility itself.
When we pulled up, they kind of walk you through the doors, and Intermountain was a lockdown. I don't even know what it's licensed as, if it's a residential treatment center or if it's a psychiatric facility, but you walk through the doors, they open and they just shut behind you, that magnetic lock sound, and you just know you can't back up. There's no option. And I remember hearing that noise, and even in my 15-year-old brain knew that life would never be the same.
Sure.
And I could just almost feel my childhood just like drain out of my body.
Right.
And I remember they take all my things and they bring it into a back room, and they say that they have to search everything before I get it. And I arrived right before Super Bowl. It was like a Friday before Super Bowl weekend, I think. So the doctor wasn't going to be in until like Monday or Tuesday. So that meant I wasn't going to get like my shoes and like things like that until then. And so I remember it was Boise in January, snow on the ground and cold. And I wasn't allowed to like have anything. And when you arrive to a place like that, it's you're on safety. So you're not allowed to have anything that you could potentially harm yourself with. So no pencils or anything like that. So I remember thinking like it definitely felt like a prison. And you have to remember that I grew up in a like very like nice neighborhood and went to, you know, private schools. And I was, I mean, for lack of a better term, like very privileged. And sure. I had no idea what was going on. I had never been exposed to even a lot of the conditions that these children in this facility had. I didn't know what an eating disorder was. I didn't know what like self-harm and things like that were. And so it was very, very scary to such a naive person and sheltered person as I was at that point. And so I was definitely full of fear in the same way I can imagine one would be if they were like put into a prison or a juvie. And I remember the main feeling I had was fear and knowing I didn't belong there. And there's even like in my doctor's notes that he would write to my parents, he would even say she continually maintains that she doesn't belong here and she doesn't have bipolar disorder and that we're wrong. It's just funny because like I was right. So it's definitely that feeling of, oh shit, this is real. And it's scary.
Right. Well, and it's such a melting pot. I mean, you're around like, cause again, you're coming at it from like you were doing some things that, again, someone could have probably walked you through, you know, like, hey, these things aren't good ideas at exactly. this point. Or, but the range that I hear about in these homes where you have the kid who has super strict parents who snuck out to the movies and ends up here. And then you have the kid who's actually involved in gangs and potentially, you know, could get into a situation that involves like murder or a serious thing that needs to be addressed in a totally different way. That whole spectrum exists within these facilities. And then you've got you there who's, you're skipping class and smoking pot, which this all feels like an extreme overreaction to. And so you're there for 6 months, if I remember right,
right.
for this initial facility. Mm-hmm. What led to you transferring to a different one? Did you just time out there? Like, what was the reason you switched facilities?
So, I mean, you know, while I was sent away for those exact behaviors, the reason why my parents thought that a place like Intermountain would be the best place is because everyone was convinced that they didn't know everything going on within me and that I was self-medicating. And so the assumption in the hospital that was made is that I'm bipolar. And so immediately they just chock full of antipsychotics and all of that. And so now it wasn't just those behaviors that we were addressing. Now it's this long-term condition, right, that we need to take care of. So my understanding is that even before the hospital, they had Chrysalis, my next place, lined up. And I just didn't know about it until like a couple months before I went. But Chrysalis was a place that they actually never, very, very rarely, maybe one or two girls I know were ever accepted. If it wasn't a second placement, they required a first placement at either a wilderness program or an RTC. So my parents knew that. And so this was the first placement. So they had the option of wilderness therapy or RTC and things like that. And because of their assumption that I was self-medicating, they thought a psychiatric evaluation was the best way to go. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know, but my parents knew the whole time. And my therapist at the time kind of started prepping me for this new place that's going to be incredible in northern Montana. And, you know, so it begins.
Right, right. And through this, you don't have any sense of like an end date on this, right? Like they're not giving you, because that's the other thing I never thought about till you were describing this, is when you go to juvie, you have a time for a sentence, right? You have a time frame. Exactly. You're going to be there. For you and again thousands of others that you deal with on a regular basis, like there's no end point in sight.
Correct.
Like there's this kind of nebulous range that's really dependent on whoever the person is that writes that piece of paper to your parents. So going to the second facility, you've now been in this world. Hey, everybody, we're going to get back to the show in just a minute. But before our brief intermission, I'd like to introduce a thought-provoking new podcast called Psychotherapy. That's two words if you're going to go search for it right now. This show sheds light on the very real issue of abusive therapists and pastoral counselors. In every helping profession, including therapy, there's a vulnerability to exploitation. And Psychotherapy delves deep into the red flags, risks, and real-life stories of those affected by unethical practices. Tune in to Psychotherapy with Leah Denton on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your shows.
I'm Leah Denton, and this is Psychotherapy, a show dedicated to providing survivors of therapy harm a platform to share their stories and to offer language for those of us trying to make sense of our own experiences with the psycho in the therapist chair.
World in the system for 6 months, like what's your emotional state at that point? Do you just feel like, well, I'm stuck here till I'm 18? Is it something where you go, let's try to conform as quickly as possible and get out of here? Like you're at that point, you're fairly institutionalized, I have to imagine, because you've been in it for so long. Like what are you feeling going into facility number two?
I think the facilities were so incredibly different that it was kind of a shock. And it's interesting. I kind of talk about this in my book that, you know, you hate the hospital when you're there, right? I hated Intermountain Hospital, and I thought of it as, oh my God, I just want to get out. But there was a part of me when I went to Chrysalis, even though it was a lot more relaxed, it's a different environment. And I almost yearned for the environment of the hospital and because it was familiar and it wasn't the new scary place that I was at. And so that was like the first feeling I feel like I had. And I had adapted to that environment already. So I started acting in the exact same way. And that was unacceptable at this place. And I think what was so different about Chrysalis was just the way that it worked. You know, they didn't lock up everything. They had, you know, an open kitchen with knives there and the doors weren't locked. And, you know, we live in a log cabin in the, you know, middle of the woods where that's 14 miles to the nearest anything. And there's house parents that are a married couple and they double as your therapist. And just the relationship dynamics were strange. Right. And, but it, they made it feel like a family. And we even called each other our Chrysalis sisters and a Chrysalis family. It had that very, in my opinion, the cult feel. And the groupthink was very present. Like you had to conform to the Chrysalis standard. So it was a lot different of a feeling than the hospital. The hospital was all about control and removing control from me and making sure I'm just kind of feeling helpless and learning what it feels like to have that learned helplessness. And Chrysalis was really that extra push to what in my mind is break me down, to fully indoctrinate me, to be able to acquiesce to the Chrysalis program. And so when I got there, there wasn't so much of a pushing back, more of a anything I tried didn't seem to work. And I got quickly labeled under certain labels and stigmas that really followed me for 3 years. And I had to fight against who they thought I was and what they thought I was doing, and ended up having to pretend like I had these issues just to be able to like advance the program. Right. But I fully became indoctrinated and believed in it. So it was, I still had that need to be accepted, right? So that was the 3 years of Chrysalis, was trying anything I could to get in Mary and Kenny's good graces. That's all I really cared about.
Yeah, it sounds like the first facility was very much, like you said, the control, the a lot more physical, like, hey, you're not going to have access to this and this and this.
Yeah.
The second one, when I hear you describe it, does feel very much emotionally manipulative, where it's like you almost have to, like you said, regress to fit the mold of what they've already labeled you to be.
Correct.
And it's incredible, because in your story, you know, you really did buy into the program. Like you did near the end, like start really going, okay, this is saving me. This is like the program that's changing things. This is my family now, after 3 years with these people, to the point where you become a vocal proponent of systems like that. You know, I won't go too deep into that process, but because I want people to go read the book and kind of see some of that journey laid out. But when did the switch happen from, hey, this was actually really helpful, it was the tough love I needed, you know, kind of view on it, to, okay, this was not that. Like this was actually really toxic and did far more harm than it ever did good.
You know, it's funny, I'm having a realization, like, as I sit here and kind of, you know, we always have these wake ups, we all know about them, when you just have like a realization, like, oh, wait a second. I'm having one right now, because, you know, when I think about it, I don't know if I ever really did believe in the Chrysalis program. I think what I really needed and believed in was being accepted. And so it was almost a, like, kind of a spurting of scripts that I knew I was supposed to do. And that those scripts led to being accepted and having friends and being loved and success. And, you know, you fill in the blank. And I think that I just became really accustomed to, you know, repeating those scripts both to myself and to others. And I think it also acted as a really good defense mechanism for myself to dig into exactly what happened there. Right. Everything from how I described that time in my life, you know, people would say, where'd you go to high school? And I'd say, oh, a boarding school, right? It wasn't a boarding school. It was definitely not. But that point that it really went to, oh, wait, I was abused, was really during the This Is Paris documentary, to be honest. It was during the scene when she was talking about how she was abducted. And what did it for me was the same words that were used with Paris were the same words used with me. And I was like, how could that be? Because she went to these places and I went to a completely different place. How is that possible that the same scripts are being used? And, you know, that's when I go on to find out that it's an industry and it's a for-profit industry and that there's a gigantic community of survivors. And at that point, I didn't even know. It took that to really understand it wasn't just Chrysalis Girls in the world. Like there right. were other programs and they were creating survivors. And I had never heard that word before, a survivor. And, you know, that was the first of my few big wake ups that I go in full detail in the book. But the small wake ups were really kind of like thinking about not an overall experience, more just like a thing that happened, for instance. And that was really, you know, coming out of being a mom. I've got four kids ranging in age from 3 to 13. And when I became a mom, I started seeing things not through Meg's eyes, but through like what it would be like to have to happen to one of my kids. So a mom's eyes, right? So I started viewing my own experiences as, what if that was to happen to Spencer? What if that was to happen to Jackson or Harper? How would I feel if a therapist had Spencer sit on his lap? Oh my God, that's abuse. Wait, how would I feel if Spencer's therapist enjoyed wrestling with her? Oh my God, that's abuse. And it started off with little like things like that, that was easily covered up in my defensive, my almost like my coping mechanisms not being ready for the trauma yet almost.
Right.
And so it would be covered up by, oh, that's Chrysalis. No one would understand because that's just how Chrysalis was. Right.
It was different. Seem abuse.
Yeah, exactly. You just kind of explain it away in your head. And all those little things that I had realized about, you know, in relation to viewing it through my kids' eyes all came back during the documentary. You know, that's when it was like, I remember just crying my eyes out, just bawling. Like, I was like 6-7 months pregnant too with Bentley at this point.
That's and
I was
bad just, timing to watch. Yeah, a bad timing. Like
I know. That. I know. And I remember my husband Ben came in and he was like, "Are you okay?" And he like touched my arm and I was like, "No touch." I was just like, "I can't," you know, like I can't do it. And it was the little moments coming into one big catastrophic event, which, I mean, it was a whirlwind for sure.
Yeah. With how many survivors and how many of these homes there are, which it's even hard to know exactly because of how many unlicensed and unregistered homes that exist all over the place run by small churches and groups and things like that. It's amazing how underground it all still is. And, you know, you mentioned you're somebody that was in one of these programs, but it took a documentary from Paris Hilton, which I think was on nobody's, you know, bingo card for that year right. to kind of really bring a lot of public awareness to it. And I know for myself, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you when we sent a message back and forth here and there, but, you know, growing up, we had a former staff member of Agape that taught at our Christian school in California. Mm. And so he would present Agape often. And I always thought, oh, it's great. They're either, because you get the spiel, these kids that come to our school were either going to go to juvie or they were going to end up dead. And they came to our school instead and rode horses. And now they're, you know, thank God they're saved. And at the time, I thought that they were amazing. And even starting the podcast, I didn't even think to even go into that world because it was just a positive thing that existed. I didn't correlate that in abuse at all. And then the Hepzibah House stuff started really coming out. I talked to Amanda Householder and she mentioned Agape and I was like, what's wrong with Agape? Like, like, let's start talking about it. And then you start realizing, oh, there's thousands of, you know, people who've been impacted by homes like this all over the country. And they all are like photocopies of each other to varying degrees. Yeah. Once you realize there's an industry here, like you figured this out in like 2020, I think is when the series came out.
That's when it started for sure.
What pushed you so quickly to go like, okay, let me spring into action and start tackling this? You're 7 months pregnant watching the series. You know, you've got a life now that is very much detached from that in some ways, but still impacted, obviously. Like, what makes you make the jump to go like, okay, public advocacy, like, let's take this stuff down?
I think it was, you know, at first there was that need for finding other people like me, which it was actually pretty hard to find the survivor community. And I didn't really find them right away. I wanted to feel validated and find out more information. I'm very much like I want to be informed about all this stuff and learn as much as I can and kind of deep dive into all the aspects of things. It was really hard to find that though at that time. I didn't, you know, I found some stuff from like England journals or whatever about boarding school syndrome, but really nothing more than that. But beyond that, what really I was driven by was how much my body shut down after that. Just the CPTSD symptoms that were like really coming into play. It was I remember sitting on the couch multiple times and my brain was fine. Like I wasn't having any like weird thoughts or thinking about past abuse, but my body would start reacting as though I was in a fight or flight response. So my heart would start pounding and I would start sweating and feeling, you know, these things. And I'm like, my brain's fine. Why is my body acting like I'm in danger? So there was like this really crazy disconnect. And then I started seeing a lot of symptoms of like, effects of, I'd be in a conversation and the second any criticism started, this is a non-professional relationship. So this is like personal relationships, you know, when something would be like critical of me, my body felt like it was shutting down. And it was like this crazy feeling I had. And I was like, I need to figure this out because I don't want to live my life like that, right?
No.
The world is full of conflict and constructive criticisms that I want to be able to take. And so I was really driven by actually wanting to feel better. And I'm a very big proponent in mental health and therapy and all of that. And my first drive was actually, I'm going to tackle this shit and I'm going to make sure that I'm not affected by my trauma like I currently am. And I'm going to never stop until I'm able to live my life in the way that I know that I can, which is not being scared of panic attacks and, you know, not being scared to leave the house, which I've gone through periods of. And so I was really driven, and that's what actually got me into EMDR, which saved my life. And once I got into EMDR, and I was doing like, I don't know, like 3 or 4 hours a week of EMDR therapy. And at that point, I knew I wanted to do advocacy work, but I also knew that the trauma I was feeling was going to be replicated in countless other survivors. And if I wanted to deal with the information that was going to be downloaded onto me every day, I knew I had to be more processed and ready for that. And so that's when I started that 6-month-ish time of doing EMDR therapy. And I decided I wasn't going to start any advocacy work until I was at a place where I wasn't feeling as disassociated. And I had really bad disassociation for years. I didn't feel like I had my own thoughts and derealization. And so I had to really start to prove myself that I was capable of feeling normal. And that is when I ended up finding the community and kind of going into that route in the advocacy world.
Yeah. I think that's huge. And it's something that, you know, and I'm sure you probably see this all the time when you're talking to people who are in that stage of realization that, oh, this wasn't healthy. And I think sometimes some people have the mentality, you know, hey, I don't want to do anything with it. That's the past. And I think that's totally respectable.
Absolutely.
Like, to not want to deal with it. And then there's people who want to jump in to advocacy or jump into just doing a podcast episode or writing a blog post, but they haven't taken the time to really work through it personally. Right. And, you know, it's one of those things, like once you put it out there, it's out there. So I think it's good to take that time, like you just mentioned, to okay, when am I ready to take this on? Because I'm about to open the floodgates of other people messaging me about this. I'm going to deal with all of the, you know, all the unexpected dramas that come from dealing in this world. Like, I think it's really commendable that you recognize you need to take that time. Cause I've talked a lot of people off the ledge who are like, let me do a podcast interview. I'm like, you just told your husband about this, or you just told your wife about this, or you just told me about it. And I'm the first person you've ever told, like, let's take a second and really make sure that we're ready for this decision. And I think that's huge. I think that's good for people to hear. Still, even with all that, you're still moving at a pretty lightning speed into this world. And because of the Paris Hilton name, the attention on that just shot up like 1,000 times what it was. Like, was there anything that you didn't expect? I'm sure there's a lot. Was there anything you didn't expect stepping into that public forum that you wish in hindsight you would have prepared yourself for, that maybe no amount of, you know, work that you had done did prepare you for initially?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I'd always been in the business of creating change, right? I've been in nonprofits my entire life. I'm very mission driven. So that was really easy. But what I didn't expect, and what therapy obviously didn't prepare me for, because it's not about processing, it's about kind of forecasting, that when you feel so close to a topic such as this, and it affects you so deeply, you have a greater amount of need for it to change. And that need can sometimes translate into, well, oftentimes translate into trying to do too much too fast, mm-hmm. and wanting it to change, you know, overnight. And I think that one of the most common things that I see, and it happened to me as well, is really overworking and just kind of telling yourself that Rome wasn't built in the day is really important. And right. also that it, you know, change isn't dependent on any one person. And to really lean on other people and rely on other people and advocate for yourself for breaks, for, you know, taking breaks in general from advocacy work. And I mean, I do that all the time. I've heard people make fun of me, like how I will literally go to a hotel for 2 or 3 nights and I shut off. It's the only way that I can get away from kid noises and adult noises and advocacy noises and just reset. And I think whatever way you can make that happen, it is imperative to your mental health and really across the board with any advocacy work you do. If you don't do that, you're going to see advocacy burnout. And it's, you know, it's very, very common. And I think the other thing I would say is, you're not going to be well liked by everyone. And, you know, as someone who's a survivor of attack therapy and the various names that goes by, we all know them, that, you know, it's really important to realize that you're going to come in contact with people who don't like you, don't agree with something you did, or have their own opinions and views on something or decision you made. And that's okay. Like, it's okay to not be liked by everyone. And we need to realize that the program telling us that we have to conform and fit into that box, you know, and otherwise it means we're doing something wrong, is totally false. And, you know, really, the more you do, the more pushback I see. And it's something to pay attention to, because it's going to hit you like a frying pan to the face if you don't, like, just prepare yourself for a potential conflict, you know, and just remove yourself from it, because it's never about you. It's about the other people. And, you know, we're all survivors. We all have our own reactions and ways of dealing with things, and just kind of realizing that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting hearing you talk about it, because I know I say all the time, like, we're default fundamentalists. Like, I come from a very fundamentalist background, and I see people leave fundamentalism that are still very much to their core fundamentalists. They've just changed what their fundamental beliefs are.
Very true.
And they'll attack anybody who disagrees with any minute point. I mean, the stuff I've heard just from doing this show, where they go, you talked about it this way and you should have talked about it this way, or you had this guest, you should have had this guest, you know, whatever. And I see it because I have a lot of friends now who are survivors of the troubled tea industry. And you mentioned the word conformity, and I see these fractures happening in that world as an outsider looking in. And I see people demanding conformity to the way they think advocacy should be done.
Yeah.
When there's so much room for all of the different angles, like exactly. The people that think legislation's a waste of time, like there's plenty of work to be done in educating parents. For the people that think that's a waste of time, there's plenty of work to be done on the legislative front. And, you know, whatever type of advocacy work or awareness is trying to be raised about any issue, like I think people should step outside the programmed kind of thinking and look at the diversity and like this mosaic of people that all have different abilities, skills, and even ideas of how to go about making change. And it makes me sad when I see people splitting in ways that are super horrific, because all it does is hurt any form of progress. It just kind of halts it right in its tracks.
It's like we're not dealing with like some like competitive industry where we're all competing for like the best of anything. All we, you know, we're in nonprofit space and activism in general, and it's all about change. And however people decide, as long as there's no one being hurt, obviously we're not going to murder staff members or something like that. But
you're on the record as saying that is not the way to do it.
Do not go do anything illegal. But like, if it's all activism and it's all in good faith, like there's room for everyone. And I don't really care what path you take toward helping people. It's helping people. And I feel like we need to encourage every advocate to do that in their own way, regardless of how they get to the end point. And I think the most important thing is just remembering like compassion, right? I say it all the time. It's my favorite quote in the world. Always take the high road. There's less traffic up there. And it's really, really, really hard at times to see, you know, like really negative things about yourself, even personally, beyond like, you know, professional stuff, and to not let it affect how I feel myself and how I view my work and my whole life in general. But it's really important to realize that it's not about you, right? It's about everyone going through their own things, and you never know what someone's going through behind the keyboard or behind the phone or the Zoom or whatever it's happening on. And just trying to see everything with a lens of compassion, that at the end of the day, you know, beyond the insults or criticisms, we're all survivors, but we're also human. And it's about just having that base level of really just compassion and understanding.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing all of this on this episode. I appreciate you taking the time to write a book that people can read explain all of this in great detail. I'm just curious for those who are listening and are saying, okay, I want to become involved in some way in helping take action in these areas. What would be the best first step for somebody to take? Because like we said just a second ago, there's 1,000 different people, you know, screaming different ways to get involved. Like, what do you think is a good step one for someone who's looking at this and going, I want to see change happen. I don't know how to initiate it.
I think you got to first figure out how you want to be helping that change along. There's so many different ways of activism. You know, you could be someone that wants to use your actual voice, and you find as many podcasts as you can, and you go on to every single one and you tell your story and you create awareness like that. Maybe you don't like to use your voice and you like to type. Maybe it's about going to different forums and sharing things and writing your story instead of showing your face. You know, maybe it's about getting information out there. Maybe you're uncomfortable with even people knowing it's you, and you just want to put documents out there and be a document finder. Maybe, you know, it's just about first figuring out what the industry looks like and what makes it up. And then you can kind of figure out like, ooh, I want to target that area. Right. And that's kind of why we created the Unsilenced Activism Network, is because sometimes the community, you know, in terms of like Facebook groups and following on Instagram and TikTok, can seem really far removed, and you can't really get a feel for what activism actually feels like beyond just videos and posts. And so the Unsilenced Activism Network, we've got close to almost 500 people, I think, right now in our network. And it allows us to interact more with the community and to kind of share that activism, figure out what they want to see and what they want to be doing. And it helps us too. It helps the team understand like, you know, if we want to see this change, what do you guys think the best way to get there is, right? And that collaboration is extremely powerful. And so I think that's where I always say is a good start, is you see so many different kinds of activism within that network and different ways of getting involved. It gives you like a little like taste of different things to figure out what is going to suit you. And like I was, for instance, I just started this social hour call with the Mighty Network, the activism network that we have. And yesterday we had our first, you know, get to know you, get to know the team, get to know the community kind of meeting. And someone basically said, like, you know, here they are in this activism network. And they said, I want nothing to do with the activism. I'm here for the community and the people. Hmm. If that's your activism, that is activism in my mind. Like right, that 100% right. is so needed within the activism community and advocacy community, is having someone to talk to and having someone who's going to validate and have a friend. That's so huge, right? So maybe that's what your role looks like. And you might not know until you kind of join forces.
Yeah, love that. Well, thank you so much again for doing this. I know we're a couple yeah. minutes over, but
no worries.
I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're incredibly busy, and I'm so excited for people to check out a copy of your book, Becoming Yay. Unsilenced, which is out right now. If you're listening to this episode, you can go grab a copy wherever you buy books. But Meg, thank you so much. I hope it's not our last conversation. I'm sure we'll cross paths again sure. in the future.
Yes.
But thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.